Well, good morning. It's great to be with you guys today. I've absolutely loved being a part of this community, and it's always an honor and pleasure to share with you guys. And today, I want to start off by showing you a picture of my 9-year-old son, Reese. That's him in the Dodgers jersey there on his 9th birthday, and I'm glad he's in a Dodgers jersey for all my San Francisco fans that are out there. But this past weekend, we're at a barbecue, and Reese is running around with bare feet on, and all of a sudden he comes hopping over to us on one leg, and he's got tears in his eyes, and his face is red, and he's got blood dripping from his foot. Well, we get him cleaned up, we take him over to the picnic bench, clean the blood off of him, get a Band-Aid on him, tape up his foot, and a little while later that night we take him home, and when we get him home, Mom says we really ought to soak his foot in the bathtub, make sure it's okay. So we put his foot in the bathtub with some Epsom salt. We're soaking it. And after a little bit, we realize that there's a little piece of glass stuck in this kid's foot. Well, for most of the next hour, my wife and I work at getting this piece of glass out of this little 9-year-old boy's foot. She's holding the needle and the tweezers, and I'm holding the flashlight, and then we switch off, and I start digging with the needle, and she holds the flashlight. And during this event, my son was experiencing all sorts of emotions. One of them was fear of pain, right? Like, it's going to hurt. He was really scared. And part of it was actual pain. I mean, it was not a pretty sight. It's painful for the kid. There was also some grief. As a matter of fact, at one point he says to me, "Dad, I just wish we could go back in time and that I wouldn't have taken my shoes off." I'm like, "I wish we could too, buddy. I really do." You know, how many of us in our lives look back and wish we wouldn't have taken our shoes off? Maybe we have moments that we wish we could have back, or choices that we wish we could rewind or delete or not do at all. We all have things in life that we grieve, bad choices that we've made. Well, a couple of times during this hour from hell, where Reese, his foot, is hurting, he says to me, "Dad, I just want to go to bed. I just want to go to sleep." And I'm like, "I wish we could let you, buddy, but we can't." So I knew if he went to bed, the inflammation would get worse. There'd be a greater chance of infection. The swelling would happen. It actually hurt more in the morning. And he wanted to just go to bed. And I'm like, "We can't do that. And I'm really sorry because I know this hurts and this stinks." And sometimes life is so frustrating and so sad that we just want to go to bed. We don't want to face reality. We don't want to deal with what's in front of us. But rarely do things get better by simply ignoring them. Well, we move our little mobile medical unit from the bathtub to his bed, and we broke out some reinforcements. We grabbed the laptop, and we pulled up Major League Baseball top plays for him to watch. And we bring in his Aunt Carol, and his Aunt Carol's holding the flashlight, and Mom's working the needle and tweezers. And I am watching Major League Baseball with my buddy. He's holding my hand, and I am completely overreacting to every play. Like, "Could you believe that catch, buddy? Oh my gosh, he hammered that ball." I'm doing anything to just deflect his attention from the pain that he's experiencing. And as he's holding my hand, I said, "Anytime it hurts, just squeeze harder." And so he'd squeeze my hand when it hurt. And at one time, he says to me, at one point he says, "Dad, with as hard as Mom is squeezing my foot, she could hit a home run." Well, after a fairly excruciating hour, we finally get that piece of glass out of his foot. And when it was all over, Reese actually says, "Mom, you're the best mom ever." I was like, "Dude, that's pretty sweet." Well, Ecclesiastes chapter 3 tells us that there's a time for everything and a season for every activity under the heavens, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. The passages that we're going to look at today cause a contradiction of emotions. They actually there's David, King David, he's like an emotional warrior, and he's got this response that we're not really sure if it makes sense to some news that he gets. On the one side, we would expect joy and celebration by King David. And on the other side, we understand sadness and despair. If you haven't been with us, we're in the middle of a series called The Life and Lyrics of David. And we're about to transition to a new part of the saga. And so I want to catch you up just in case you haven't been with us. The nation of Israel actually started out in the Promised Land and was initially governed by God-appointed and anointed judges. They were like the spiritual leaders of the community. And God said, I'm going to have judges rule my people. But the people of Israel, they eventually wanted a king of their own. They wanted to be like all the other nations. And they beg and plead, and God finally says, fine, I'll give you a king. And when he does give them this king, King Saul, the Bible describes him as a head taller than every other person in the land. So he's got the physical appearance of a king. He looks like a king. But Saul's got his own demons. He had some good moments, but most of them are remembered as bad. He struggled with self-doubt and insecurity and grief and anger. Well, a number of years into his reign, King Saul actually ignores and rejects God to the point where God finally removes his anointing and blessing from Saul. And then he anoints a new king, David. But David doesn't receive the throne immediately. As a matter of fact, he has to wait years and years and years before God actually gives David the throne. And in the meanwhile, Saul becomes jealous and angry and does everything in his power to capture and destroy David. And so Saul is the king of Israel, and he's actually fighting two different battles. He's fighting a battle against the neighboring Philistines, their menacing enemy, and he's also fighting kind of the civil war as he chases David and his 600 warriors. Well, as David had to seek refuge, he and his warriors ended up in a Philistine border town called Ziklag. And just a little side note, I'll frequently use the audio function on my iPhone to prepare these messages. I'll record what I'm saying. And when I said Ziklag, it came up as Six Flags. So David and his guys hung out in Six Flags for over a year. Well, as David and his guys are in Ziklag, at one point they leave the town to go join a battle, and when they come back, they find out that the Amalekites, another enemy, had kidnapped their wives and their children and plundered their city. They'd taken everything. And so David and his warriors, they go chase these Amalekites down. It says that they capture them, they destroy them, they kill them, and they get all of their kids back, their wives back, and their goods back. And so there in Ziklag, as this is going on, in the meanwhile, Saul has gotten so far away from God, and God had quit communicating with him, that Saul went to see a medium, and he goes to talk to this medium about his future and what to do in this battle. And he hears from this medium that he and his sons are actually going to die in battle the very next day at the hands of the Philistines. So the news isn't good for Saul. So as we pick this story back up, we've got Saul 3 days to the north at Mount Gilboa, and we have David 3 days to the south at Six Flags. Okay? All right, well, we return to the scriptures. 1 Samuel chapter 31, verse 1. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, so they're battling Saul and his army. The Israelites fled before them, and many fell dead on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines were in hot pursuit of Saul and his sons. And they killed his sons, Jonathan, Abinadab, and Malchishua. Then in verse 3, the fighting grew fierce around Saul. And when the archers overtook him, they wounded him critically. So somebody loosed an arrow and it hit him and it wounded him to the point where he knew that he was going to die. Oh, verse 4. Saul says to his armor bearer, who would have been his closest companion in battle, he says, draw your sword and run me through, or these uncircumcised fellows will come and run me through and abuse me. But his armor bearer was terrified and would not do it. You see, Saul knew the history of the Israelite nation, And years before, a guy by the name of Samson, who was the leader of the Israelites, had been captured by the Philistines. And when he was, they gouged his eyes out and they humiliated him and tormented him. And Saul was fearful that the same thing would happen if these guys came upon him while he was alive. So he asked his armor bearer to kill him. Now, Saul's armor bearer, though, he would have been aware that David had spared Saul's life on two occasions, not willing to kill the Lord's anointed. So while this armor bearer receives this command from his king, he wasn't going to disobey his God by destroying his king. And then in verse 4, so Saul took his own sword and fell on it. Saul died much as he had lived. He did not confer with God or rely on God, but instead leaned on his own understanding and ultimately on his own sword and committed suicide. Well, then in verse 5, when the armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he too fell on his sword and died with him. So Saul and his three sons and his armor bearer and all his men died together that same day. So the long drawn out drama is finally over for David. The heir apparent to the throne, the man after God's own heart, is finally going to have his opportunity to be king. Finally, his tormentor is gone. But David and his warriors are 3 days away in Ziklag. There's no locker room tweets, no email, no cable TV, no CNN to report the action that was taking place to the north. So the only way that David was going to hear about these events was by a messenger coming and telling him what had happened. And that's what happens 3 days later. Now we fast forward to the very next book in the Bible, 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 1. After the death of Saul, David returned from striking down the Amalekites and stayed in Ziklag 2 days. On the third day, a man arrived from Saul's camp with clothes torn and dust on his head. The appearance of this man with clothes torn and dust on his head would have been a foreshadowing of bad news. Torn clothes and a head full of dust was typical funeral attire for those times. Well, then in verse 2, when he came to David, when this messenger came to David, he fell to the ground paying him honor. The messenger prostrates himself before the king in waiting. He has news, but he wants to be cautious and wise about how he delivers it. Well, then in verse 3, David asks, "Where have you come from?" And he answers, "I have escaped from the Israelite camp." So he's been on the Israelite battlefield. He's seen what's happened. He was at Mount Gilboa. And then verse 4, David asks, "What happened? Tell me." David realizes that this man has news, probably not good news, but he wants to get to the point. He wants to find out exactly what happened and what this guy knows. And then the Amalekite, the messenger, responds, "The men fled from the battle," he replied. "Many of them fell and died. And Saul and his son Jonathan are dead." And Saul and his son Jonathan are dead. What a mixture of emotions this sentence must have stirred up in David. For over 10 years, David had been pursued and tormented by this maniac. He hasn't been able to sleep in his own bed or rest comfortably. He's constantly been on the run, looking over his shoulder. And he's probably been constantly wondering, when is God going to deliver on this promise of this kingship? You know, we might expect a celebration at the news of Saul's death. Verse 5, then David said to the young man who brought him the report, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead? Tell me more. What happened? How do you know they're actually dead?" Verse 6, the Amalekite answers, "I happened to be on Mount Gilboa," the young man said, "and there was Saul leaning on his spear with chariots and their drivers in hot pursuit." In verse 7, "When he turned around and saw me, he called out to me, and I said, 'What can I do?' He asked me, 'Who are you?' 'An Amalekite,' I answered. Then he said to me, 'Stand here by me and kill me. I am in the throes of death, but I'm still alive.' You know, this messenger's oblivious to the fact that just a few days earlier, David and his warriors had killed a number of Amalekites for kidnapping their wives and children, stealing their goods. And thus far, the story's pretty identical to the historical account, but it's about to get a makeover. Verse 10, the Amalekite says, "So I stood beside him and I killed him, because I knew that after he had fallen, he could not survive. Mercifully, I killed him. I spared him torment. I spared him awfulness. I spared him the pain of death." And then it says, "And I took the crown that was on his head and the arm and the band on his arm, and I brought them here to you, my Lord." Well, this guy's posturing to win David's favor and a more prosperous future, as he believes that that David will be the new king of Israel. This account also kind of assures us, as an audience and the original audience, that David never really sought after the crown. He never went and got it himself. It was actually brought to him by somebody else, the crown and the arm badge, which would have been symbolic of his kingship. Well, the Amalekite messenger is expecting gratitude and celebration, but that's not what he gets. Verse 11, "Then David and all his men tore their clothes, or took hold of their clothes and tore them. They mourned and wept and fasted till evening for Saul and his son Jonathan, and for the army of the Lord, and for the nation of Israel, because they had fallen by the sword." They mourned, they wept. Saul's dead, Jonathan's dead, many men have died on this hill. You know, as we've read this story over the past few weeks and we've heard about the evilness of Saul and how David would take over as king, we might have expected a huge celebration or a sigh of relief or some sort of joy. But that's not what we get. David's tormentor's gone, but so is his very, very best friend. And much of the army of Israel lies slain on the side of a mountain. You know, sometimes we receive news that we're not sure what to do with. You know, maybe you've got a dream job opportunity, but you know that it's going to require moving away from family and friends. Perhaps your dream school turns you down and you're not sure what to do now. You know, maybe you've been married for a while and you've just recently received news that you're going to struggle to get pregnant. You know, we get all sorts of different news and we're not quite sure how to deal with it, how to react to it. Well, David and his warriors, they mourn. They mourn all afternoon. They cry, they tear their clothes, and they just wallow in their grief. They spend time focusing on the information they just received. But then David's attention returns to the messenger. Verse 13, "David said to the young man who brought him the report, 'Where are you from?' He answers, 'I am the son of a foreigner, an Amalekite.'" Well, this information would have confirmed to David that this messenger knew who Saul was, knew that he was anointed by God, and knew that David had spared his life on two different occasions. Verse 14, David asked him, "Why weren't you afraid to lift your hand to destroy the Lord's anointed?" Why weren't you afraid to do the very thing I refused to do on two different occasions? The Lord's anointed, the Lord was the only one who had the right to take his life. Once I had the opportunity to kill this guy in a cave to take Saul's life, and I didn't do it. Another time, I was over him at night and could have taken his life, and I didn't do it. But you think that you can take this man's life. Well, verse 15 is David's response. "Then David called one of his men and said, 'Go, strike him down.' So he struck him down, and he died. For David had said to him, 'Your blood be on your own head. Your own mouth testified against you when you said, I killed the Lord's anointed.'" You know, frequently when we think of grief, we think of the passing of a loved one. But grief can show up in all sorts of ways. You know, maybe for you, your 5-year-old daughter is about to start kindergarten. She's the oldest child, and you're about to go into this new season of life, and you're going to miss those toddler ages. Maybe you grew up in a different faith, and leaving meant the loss of friendships severed relationships, and now you're wrestling with what to believe. But how about when your grief is about a person who actually hurt you, who made your life hell? Well, the reality is that we need to grieve both the Sauls in our lives and grieve the Jonathans in our lives. It's important to grieve both. We naturally and readily grieve the Jonathans, but David grieved Saul as well. Recently, I had a weird window into grief. We have this big pine tree next to our house. It's actually planted far too close to our house. It was about 6 feet tall when we moved in, but this is what it looks like today. It's close to 20 feet tall, and I'm pretty sure its main purpose in life is to collect my kids' toys. Over the years, we've lost baseballs, wiffle balls, racquetballs, footballs, frisbees, hockey pucks, tennis balls, and Nerf darts in that tree. And every time I go to dig something out of that tree, I need to pull on my Carhartt jacket and the leather gloves because it's really prickly to get in there. Well, about a year ago, the kids lost a ball in the tree, and they come and say, "Dad, can you go get this ball? Can you dig it out for us?" And so I go and I start to dig in this tree, and as I'm looking in there, I get this startle, and I realize that just 12 inches from my nose is a magpie. But this wasn't any normal magpie. This bird happened to be quite clearly dead. He was laying there. It looked like he'd been dead a long time. And he's sitting in the tree. Well, I did what any squeamish bird lover would do. I left him right there. I figured that's as good a resting place as any for this bird. Well, fast forward about a year, I pull into our driveway and I look under that tree and I see something black and white under the tree. And I realize the bird had finally fallen out of the tree and he's laying there dead. Well, I go into the house and a little while later I hear this noise in my front yard and I go out front. And there's like six magpies circling this bird at a distance. They're all squawking at him. And I did some research online, and apparently magpie funerals are something that really happen. They gather around. And I don't know if these birds knew the deceased. I don't know if they were angry the way they were squawking. Or maybe they just showed up to pay homage. I did know I wasn't going to get in between them and this dead bird. But it's interesting how we all grieve. We grieve in different ways. You know, I want to change the subject. I want to deflect attention. I want to avoid the feelings. But that's not how David handles grief. He seems to go towards it. I think that we can learn something from David and how he handles grief and how he can help us with our own junk as he leans into grief. And he doesn't do it forever and not in ridiculous ways, but he doesn't avoid it. He allows himself to feel grief. According to the Center for Grief and Healing, there are some popular myths about grief, and the biggest one is this myth: the pain will go away faster if you ignore it. How many of you probably try that on a regular basis? If I just ignore it, it's going to go away. But the facts are that trying to ignore your pain or to keep it from surfacing will only make it worse in the long run. For real healing, it's necessary to face your grief and to actively deal with it. And I'm discovering that God helps you heal when you take the time to feel. We need to allow ourselves to feel so that we can actually heal. We need to allow ourselves to feel that pain so that God can work in our lives and heal us. And that's what David does. He focuses on the loss. 2 Samuel chapter 1, verse 17, David took up this lament concerning Saul and his son Jonathan, and he ordered the people of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. It is written in the book of Jashar, or the book of the upright. This was a collection of ancient songs. So David doesn't just mourn the loss of his dear friend Jonathan, but also Saul, his first king, the king of Israel. And he doesn't just let the memory fade away. He writes about it. He engages it. Well, Lewis Smead writes in his book, Keeping Hope Alive. He says this, if we expect to keep hope alive, we need to keep memory alive. Happy memories of good things we hope for that were fulfilled. Grateful memories of bad things we survived. And that's what David does. He keeps memory alive, and he instructs all of Judah to memorize and recite this lament. Well, then the lament starts. Verse 19 says, a gazelle lay slain on your heights, Israel. How the mighty have fallen. The Hebrew word here that's translated gazelle can actually be translated honored as well. So this verse could quite easily say, the honored lie slain on your heights. And three times in this lament, David repeats the words, how the mighty have fallen, how the mighty have fallen. It's the refrain of the chorus of the song, and it actually reveals how David feels about both of these men, that the mighty have fallen. Well, in verse 20, the lament continues, tell it not in Gath, proclaim it not in the streets of Ashkelon, lest the daughters of the Philistines be glad, lest the daughters of the uncircumcised rejoice. Gath and Ashkelon were both Philistine cities. And David says, don't let word get back to our enemies, lest they celebrate. Don't let them gloat over this victory. Well, then in verse 21, mountains of Gilboa, may you have neither dew nor rain. May no showers fall on your terraced fields. For there the shield of the mighty was despised. The shield of Saul no longer rubbed with oil. David cries out, no more rain or dew on these mountains. He says, dry it up, make it parch, make it awful. He asks God to curse this land where Saul and Jonathan died. Up until this morning, I was starting to wonder if we were cursed as a land. Now that we've got just a little bit of rain, maybe things are going to turn here. Well, then in verse 22, he continues, from the blood of the slain, from the flesh of the mighty, the bow of Jonathan did not turn back. The sword of Saul did not return unsatisfied. David honors both of these men as brave and effective warriors. He eulogizes them with admiration for their great deeds. In verse 23, Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and admired, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles, they were stronger than lions. According to David, these weren't ordinary men. They were fast and brave and strong, and he recalls their military prowess. Worthy of admiration, he focuses on their good. And then he goes on in verse 24 to say, daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. He's saying, Saul was your first king. He led you, he provided for you, he made your life better. When you think of him, honor him. But reality is, it's not easy to think positively of someone who has hurt you or has made your life miserable, is it? But David does lament Saul's passing. And I don't know what remembering or honoring a painful loss might look for you, like for you. But I don't think God wants you to ignore it. I think he wants you to spend time processing it, and he wants to meet you in it with his love and his comfort. Then verse 25, how the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lies slain on your heights. And then he focuses his attention on Jonathan, David's closest friend. Jonathan supported David when his dad wanted to kill him. Now, I know a lot of you probably want to kill your kids' friends, but none of you are throwing spears, I hope. And then he says, Jonathan and David actually dreamed of a time when they would be partners in ruling the kingdom, that David would become the king and that Jonathan would be his second-hand man. And so when Jonathan dies, that dream has died. And then David writes in verse 26, I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of women. know, Jonathan and David were tight. Jonathan was one of those friends who has your back, a friend who loved unconditionally, a friend who knows your junk and your struggles and cheers you on anyways. You know, they love you regardless of what's going on, what you've done, or where you've been. Troy talked about having a Jonathan in our life a few weeks ago, and I truly, truly pray that each and every one of us would be able to find a Jonathan in our life. I pray that you have someone like that, whether it's a friend, a spouse, a parent, whomever, that you know they care for you regardless of what you're doing and what's going on in your life. And for those of you that have had a Jonathan in your life and you've lost that person, maybe they've passed on, maybe they've moved away, I am so sorry for your loss, and yet so glad that you had that person in your life, that time in your life, and you can remember what it was like to be with them in that relationship and that friendship. Then verse 27 says, how the mighty have fallen, the weapons of war have perished. David finishes his lament of Saul and Jonathan. And you know, I know that our church and our community, we're all busy people, and we feel the pressure to move on. We don't have time to dwell on losses and disappointments. We want to just get on with things. But David did not just jump into taking care of the business of being a new king. He didn't sweep his feelings under the carpet. He took the time to grieve Jonathan and to grieve Saul. You know, so often we want to flee from our feelings. I'm not a good griever. I want to change the subject. I want to focus on the positive, avoid reality, and act like it's no big deal. But that's not healthy. That doesn't honor the pain. You know what happens when we avoid grief? When we avoid grief, we avoid God. We really do. He wants to meet us in that. We deny Him the chance to meet us and to minister to us in our pain. You know, God will help you heal if you take the time to feel. If you spend the time in the pain, He will help you heal. Go to God. Take the time to process your pain. And I don't know what your pain might be. Maybe it's something from a long time ago that you never dealt with. Maybe it's an ongoing struggle that you're facing. But I know this about me. God has grown me more in my pain than anything else in life. He's grown me through unmet sales goals. He's grown me through wrecked relationships, through a job loss when I had a family to provide for. He's grown me and met me as I moved away from a town and friends that I loved dearly. When I allow Him to do so, He meets me in all of those needs. He grows me and He shows me His love and His comfort. You know, even Jesus, who I think knew the outcome of everything and had His junk together more than any of the rest of us, spent some time grieving. Jesus was a busy guy with a big mission, but He lamented. In John 17, the night before His death, He prayed hard for His apostles because He knew He wouldn't be with them any longer. And He prayed any longer physically. And He prayed for their unity. And He prayed for their future. And then when Jesus heard of Lazarus' death, we're told that He wept. And when Jesus heard about the death of His cousin and His dear friend John the Baptist, the Apostle Matthew tells us in chapter 14, when Jesus heard about what happened, John's death, He withdrew by boat privately to a solitary place. Jesus didn't deflect. He dwelt on the news and the pain. He got away by Himself, presumably to be alone with His Father and to pray and to process what was going on. You know, and Jesus was the one who said, I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. And sometimes life to the full includes grief. We've leaned on the wisdom of author and Bible commentator Eugene Peterson a number of times in this series. In his book, Leap Over a Wall, he offers this keen observation about David and his grief. He says, it seems odd, even contradictory, that in order to live totally, we must face death totally. But it's true. David, who lived exuberantly, lamented fiercely. His exuberance and lamentation were aspects of the same life orientation and commitment. Life matters. This is a crazy thought, but it makes sense. To live totally, we must face death totally. To live totally, we've got to be in that space where it's like, I'm going to go there mentally and I'm going to deal with this while I don't want to deal with it. I'm going to allow God to meet me in that, whatever that source of grief or pain may be. Again, God helps you heal when you take time to feel. God helps each one of us heal as we take time to feel whatever it is that's going on in our life. And God has this uncanny ability to meet us in our pain, giving us comfort, giving us hope, and then lifting us up out of that pain. And I want you all to know, regardless of where you're at on the spiritual journey, if you believe there's a God or that Jesus exists or whatever you believe, I want you to know this about the God that I believe in and that I trust. In Psalm 30, the author writes to God, the God who wants to heal you. He says, you turn my wailing into dancing. You remove my sackcloth and clothe me in joy, that my heart may sing your praises and not be silent. Lord, my God, I will praise you forever. You see, we have a God with the desire and ability to lift us up out of our despair, to set our feet on solid ground, to give us hope and direction and the comfort of his unfailing and unmeasurable love. God wants to meet each and every one of us in our pain, whatever that looks like. Let's pray. Father, I'm certain that some of us are in the throes of pain. We might even be in the throes of death. We feel like our world is crashing down on us. Could be aging parents. It could be an ill child. It could be the loss of our career or financial burdens that look too big. God, wherever we're at, I pray that we would take the time to ask you to heal us, to ask you to meet us in that, to show us your love. And for others of us, we have friends that are in pain right now. They might be dealing with a hard divorce. They might have uncertainties in their lives. They may not know which way to go, how to recover. Maybe they've fought the same demons for years and years. God, for those of us who can, I pray that we would come beside those who are in pain and meet them and show some of your love to them. God, I just pray that regardless of what's going on in our heart, regardless of what it is, how deep the wounds, that you would heal us, that you would help us. Because I know you can and I know you want to. I pray this in Jesus' name. Amen. Okay. Homework. At Capital, homework is always optional. We always say only do it if it's going to help you. So, what could it look like to take time to heal? My first suggestion is simple. Connect with someone. Don't go it alone. When we're in pain, it is so important to get support. David lamented with his people. So find someone you can talk to share your burdens. Paul writes in his letter to the Galatian church, carry each other's burdens, and in this way you will fulfill the law of Christ. You know, we weren't wired up for isolation, so don't go it alone. Seek out help, a trusted friend, a family member, join a support group, whatever it takes. But if you're in pain, get support. You know, sometimes just sharing your grief with somebody else provides new perspective and lifts the pain and gives you hope. Next, for homework, be support. Be support. Maybe you need to get support, but maybe you could provide support. Perhaps you've been uniquely gifted to come alongside someone else. Maybe you've overcome an addiction, survived a financial calamity, gotten through a tough divorce, and you've already walked that path and you've received comfort from God. And maybe you can be a comfort to someone else. In his second letter to the church at Corinth, Paul writes, "Praise be to the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ, the Father of compassion and the God of all comfort, who comforts us in all our troubles so that we can comfort those in any trouble with the comfort we ourselves receive from God." I don't think God wastes a hurt. If you've been hurt, you could probably help someone else. Maybe God met you and comforted you in your time of trial and distress. Maybe you can help someone else as they grieve. Next, connect with a counselor. If you've been in deep grief for a long time and you don't have someone to talk to about it, or you haven't been able to cope with it like you'd hoped you would, it might be beneficial to process what you're going through with a professional. We've got a list of recommended counselors back at Guest Central, and maybe that's the best next step for you. As far as books go, one of Troy's favorite books on the subject, one he has recommended on several occasions, is Lewis Smead's Keeping Hope Alive. I referenced this book a little earlier. We have several copies at Guest Central, or you can pick it up on Amazon or Kindle or however you prefer. And now for a verse. I want to leave you guys with one verse that may be helpful and may help you talk to God about your disappointments. It's from the New Testament. It was written by the Apostle Peter. In 1 Peter 5:7, he says, "Cast all your anxiety on him," talking about Jesus, "because he cares for you." You know, we have a God who cares about our struggles. And maybe you need to just sit down with that verse and all of the burdens you're carrying, the pain that you're experiencing, just cast it on him because he cares, and see what he does to help you through it, to help you see it differently, to find hope in the situation. Now, finally, many of you are downloading these graphics and putting them on your phone or your computer. You can find them on our online bulletin or on our social media. We'll be posting them this afternoon. Please stand. Following each service, we have some folks available up here to pray with you and for you. And if you are experiencing some grief, maybe it would be a really, really good thing for you to connect with one of these folks and tell them what your pain is and ask them to bring that to God on your behalf. Or maybe you've got a friend that you know needs some prayer. They would love to come alongside you and do that, so feel free to connect with them after the service. My blessing for all of you guys is may you find the desire and courage to face any grief you've neglected. May you lament fiercely so you can live fully. And may our great and loving God meet you where and how you need to be met. Thanks for being here, guys. Grace and peace.